Check us out on iTunes, leave us a review, and enjoy your weekend. We'll be back next week at all the usual places you get your podcasts. Thanks.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We interrupt this program to bring you an important bulletin. We now go to CBS and anchor Stephen Colbert.
I have an announcement right now of an actual exclusive interview.
Wow. Wow.
That we're going to have Monday. Everybody wants this fella, right? Everybody wants him. Nobody got him but us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On Monday, I will be sitting down right here talking for the first time since he left the White House. Oh. Anthony Scaramucci will be sitting right there.
Yeah. The Mooch!
Right there. I can't believe it.
That was comedian Stephen Colbert this week, announcing that former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci will be his guest on The Late Show next week. A news story and an entertainment promo all tied up into one. Not only have President Trump and his administration become a late-night television muse, audiences are suddenly engaged. Saturday Night Live, for instance, is having its most viewed season in 22 years. What's behind this historic golden moment for satire? Is it serious political engagement, or the empty calories of escapist entertainment? That's the point in the latest issue of The Point, started by three graduate students at the University of Chicago. This fall, the magazine is taking on satire. The University of Chicago, I might point out, is a place where people go to school and fun goes to die. It's kind of a joke. But Don Baskin is a founding editor, and he seriously joins me in the studio to discuss the latest issue and how the magazine hopes that seriousness is not left behind in this race toward a good laugh.
Both during the election, there was this question of the alt-right and how they were using humor and how to respond to it without coming off as just kind of shrill and humorless jokes that many people found very offensive, but that felt in some way connected meaningfully to the Trump movement and the sort of energy behind his election. Then after the election, you know, I just personally had this experience of everywhere I went for weeks, the first question people would ask me is, did you see Saturday Night Live last weekend? Did you see Colbert? Did you see the skit about Sean Spicer or Steve Bannon or Trump?
Liar, liar, pants on fire. That's right, put them out. That's right, Spicy's back, Sarah's out.
And it sort of occurred to me to ask, what is comedy doing for people who are watching it after this election? How is it helping us cope? Is it good for us? What kind of things are we getting out of it? So those are the kinds of questions we wanted to ask about comedy.
I found myself, and I think of myself as having a pretty good sense of humor, not laughing by November. By actually mid-October. By mid-October, I just wasn't laughing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't because I didn't think it was funny, and it wasn't because I didn't think there was no talent. It was because I just felt that there was something about the comedy that, even though it might have been nailing the characters, was missing the point of why this moment is so full of anxiety. And I felt that comedy kind of got it wrong by being a diversion as opposed to drawing us into the meaning. But all my friends say, oh, shut up, John.
Well, this is a question we ask in our letter on satire that we do at the beginning of the issue. I mean, you know, people were very upset about the election. What's wrong with a little humor? You know, here was something that could be funny and that people could laugh at and made them feel good.
Let's get straight into it. If this morning you finally woke up from a coma, well, you might want to go back.
But I think the broader question that we wanted to ask was, when we engage in this kind of humor or we laugh at it, how are we engaging with what we're so upset about?
Or not engaging.
Yeah.
I mean, are liberals hiding in this little, you know, resort called comedy and, you know, sort of laughing at each other and waiting out the Trump era when perhaps engagement is what would be the imperative in a democratic society?
Yeah, so I would agree with that, but I'd also say, I mean, I do think it's a form of engagement satire. I mean, there is something political that's going on there. I guess what we felt is that it's a form of engagement that's become all too common in our democracy. It's a sort of us versus them, adorables versus deplorables act where it's always the joke is on the other side. The other people are crazy. They're stupid. They're evil. We, on the other hand, are the ones who are kind of in a position to stand back and make jokes about it. And And, you know, we ask in the editorial, not only kind of is this an escape or is it political, but what other kind of comedy could there be? Is this the only route for comedy to go in this kind of situation? And one of the things we talk about is, you know, in the history of comedy, the deepest comedy was about things that could also be tragic. Our own frustration, our own rage, our own sort of making the same mistake over and over again, our own inability to get out of this kind of dynamic of hostility and deeper divides between people in our country, that actually in the classical sense is a subject of comedy.
Turning the satire on ourselves.
Yes, that we ourselves are the sort of most intractable adversary, you know? Why do we keep thinking the same thing is going to lead to a different result? The kind of comedy that we had after the election, it was maybe more extreme, but it's really the same kind of comedy we've been having since Jon Stewart took over The Daily Show in 2000. And I think that I remember during the Bush years feeling like that comedy was extremely necessary and important. There was this kind of equivocation and refusal to say what people meant on the mainstream cable news shows. And here you had Jon Stewart every night kind of speaking the truth in a very entertaining way, it felt like.
Here's the thing, Mr. President. People that use the phrase "in other words" think you don't understand what they're saying. We understand what you're saying. The look on our face isn't confusion. It's disbelief.
But there's a question, you know, I think 18 years later, whether we now are saturated by that kind of comedy and that kind of way of – not just that kind of comedy, but that kind of way of thinking, and whether, you know, what kind of use that's really serving at this point.
What do you make of the moments that certain comedians and writers get in trouble going over the line ostensibly? Are the rules real or are they kind of fake?
I guess I'm of the opinion that there are no rules in comedy, but – I guess my question about a lot of those things is what's funny about them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it funny?
Yeah.
And if it is funny, what's the joke? I mean, you know, television stations have to make decisions about what's appropriate for their audience or whatever. But in terms of the sort of basic question of like, is comedy allowed to go there? I think sure. I think comedy can go anywhere. You know, to me, those jokes are just – I mean, I'm not even sure what the joke is a lot of the time in them.
Why is there no Charlie Hebdo impulse in American satire, something that takes ultimate risks, not necessarily even in taste? I mean, you could argue the taste question with Charlie Hebdo, and many people do, mm-hmm. but they also go for the sacred and skewer it. And I don't know what the equivalent would be in America, but it doesn't appear as though these comedians are doing much besides satirizing individual characters.
I mean, I'm sure it has to do to some extent with the tradition of satire in France, which has a different history than America. I mean, I guess what would be the equivalent of that kind of comedy in America? First, you have to locate what's sacred. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know exactly what the answer is to that.
All I would say is that I don't know if the comedians that are working now are taking much of a risk, mm-hmm. even though they're very entertaining.
Yeah.
It's also a question of if they took more of a risk, would that help?
Well, I would agree. I mean, there are lots of different kinds of risks. And, you know, Charlie Hebdo represented one kind of risk one can take. I think something to the extent that what they did was courageous was when they went after things that their own audience valued and held sacred.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, there's this question of audience. You're a comedian and you can make these very courageous jokes, you know, in quotations, about the people that aren't watching your show. You know, who are the alien other, the people that are ruining the country and not watching your show. It's more courageous in a lot of ways to, I think, you know, to make the jokes about your actual audience. That's the kind of humor that we learn from.
So to bring comedy full circle with this idea, freedom demands that we have institutions that allow us to engage openly mm-hmm. with someone as offensive as Richard Spencer. And freedom demands that comedy be able to go anywhere.
Yeah. I don't know if I would say it go as strong as demands. I mean, I think that it's hard to say depends what we mean by freedom. I think our democracy certainly benefits, that's my personal opinion, from having spaces where people can can get clear on what they believe, which involves truly understanding what other people believe. And it's only by sort of understanding someone else's value system, I think, that you can really see what your own is and what the limits of it are. How far can I go to let in someone else's idea, and where do I draw a line?
He is the controversial senior editor of Breitbart News and author of the upcoming book Dangerous, Milo Yiannopoulos. Yeah! Milo!
I think a lot of people draw those lines before they've really considered where other people are and what the implications of their ideas are. And obviously, I hope that The Point is one of those spaces. That's one of the things we try to do in The Point, is to be a place where people can really get clear on both their own ideas and the ideas of people they may vehemently disagree with.
So finally, you know, the idea of launching an intellectual magazine dedicated to liberal and controversial values of one kind or another, what gives you the idea that Americans broadly are hungry for this kind of thing?
Well, you know, I take them at their word. I mean, a lot of people talk about being sick of the kind of outrage cycle, the polemics, the polarization, the constantly, you know, we heard about the filter bubble after the election. We've heard so much about people wanting to know what other people think in the country outside of their friends and the people they live near and who are on their Facebook page. And I think that The Point for a long time, I think, has been offering that. Some people that say they want that don't really want it. Mm-hmm. As soon as they're actually confronted with it, they are disgusted, or they're not interested in it really. They really just want to watch the shows that confirm their own ideas. But, you know, I think a lot of us do really want to be involved in a conversation that's more thoughtful and that, you know, doesn't write off those that disagree with us as deplorables before we've had a chance to actually think about what they believe.
As founding editor of The Point, what's your definition of success?
To have a magazine that becomes a permanent part of our cultural conversation and that is trusted as a place where people can go to deepen their own understanding of both their own lives and of their culture and politics.
John Baskin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Baskin is a founding editor of The Point magazine.
I'll see you. Not if I see you first.
Bye-bye, boys.
Have fun storming the castle.
Good night and good luck.
Good night, sweet prince.
He's looking at you, kid.
And good luck.
In case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Yes, I'm signing off, but nobody else is going anywhere on this program, The Takeaway. And it's time for Movies, of course, on Friday with Rafer Guzman. Brother Guzman, I knew you were a star the first time you were on this program.
Thanks, John. You gave me my big break.
And Kristen went off to bigger and better things. You are bigger and better things. You get bigger every time you come in here every week.
I'm as big as I can be.
Yes. Well, let's expand your career by talking about the movies this week. Glass Castle. Let's have a clip first.
This ain't you. You ain't like those pawns, and you know it.
Don't turn this on me.
You're a Walls. You were born to change the world, not just add to the noise. You cannot marry that fool.
The voice, obviously, of Woody Harrelson.
Yes, indeed, playing Rex Walls, a real-life figure. This is based on the memoir by Jeanette Walls. Amazing story about this vagabond, semi-homeless, penniless existence she and her parents lived. Her parents lived it by choice. They just liked to wander the countryside. They would never stay any place very long, always one step ahead of the law or the bill collectors.
I used to work with Jeanette at MSNBC. She was gossip columnist there.
Right, right.
You kind of had a hint that there was more to her life, and she was definitely just on her way to something much, much bigger. And when this book came out, it was amazing.
I mean, the book is really incredible. I mean, it's one of these stories that'd be very hard to mess up on screen. It's just such a compelling story in and of itself, but they do a very good job with it. And
really?
Woody Harrelson as Rex is just amazing.
Wow.
If he's not nominated for an Oscar, I don't know what.
So you love.
I really like this movie a lot. Yeah, it's one of those movies, whether your family is functional or dysfunctional, I feel like you're really going to
good point
glom onto it.
Movie number two, Step.
I want them to understand that this is way bigger than stepping.
Okay. It's about not making excuses, making sacrifices, having a positive attitude.
I know it gets tough.
Pitch Perfect meets the step dancing you see at the end of high school assemblies nowadays?
You might think so, and that's the way this movie has kind of sold itself. You think this is going to be a look at step and sort of what this kind of sport slash dance does for these girls. Really, this is the story of these African-American girls in Baltimore trying to apply to college. And that's where the movie gets really interesting, and you see what they're up against. You know, these are girls from homes where the parents are unemployed, uninvolved. There's little money. There might be no power. There might be no food. And you see them putting on these brave faces and trying to get themselves into a college, but they've got a lot stacked against them. And that, to me, is where the meat of the movie really lies.
Does the director explicitly make this parallel story of the challenge of step dance and the challenge of getting into college? Does it work together, or is it a backstory?
You know, in some ways, I almost feel like this is a bit of a switcheroo. You know, step is what's being sold to you to kind of pull you into the theaters. But once you get in, the movie is much more about these women and sort of what their future is going to be and how they're going to get through high school, get their grades up, and get into a good college and do something with their lives. That, to me, again, like I say, the moments of candor in this film are really compelling, and it's a great documentary.
Movie number three, Annabelle, a doll maker and his wife welcome a nun and several girls from an orphanage. There you go.
There you go. What more do you want?
That's all you have to say.
If you're a fan of the Annabelle series, of the Conjuring series, you know, what I like about these movies is they take the oldest tropes in the horror genre and they do them pretty well with a very high level of craft. You've got a very high scare per minute factor here in this movie. And it's a lot of fun. Some great scares, great cast of kids, Talitha Bateman is one of the kids. What can I say? Old stuff, but done well.
Scared you.
Scared me.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. See you later, buddy.
I hope so, John.
We here always imagined The Takeaway as a program with a solid public radio mind, but with an expressive, maybe higher bandwidth voice and a completely new sound. Jake Howitt, our technical director, is way more than just the sound guy.
Try to understand. He's a magic man. Oh, yeah.
That's right. With sound and a decent idea, Jay and I like to make audio production magic as much as we can, and we've been doing that since the beginning of the program. Jay, why don't you just come in here?
Okay.
We got away with murder on this show. People don't realize that.
We killed old public radio. We killed it dead.
I mean, remember the opens that we used to do? Some of the stuff.
Well, we used to combine things like Edgar Allan Poe and Public Enemy.
Edgar Allan Poe, America's Blackness, and the Raven.
While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping.
Rapping. Gently rapping.
That's good.
That's good. I mean, I guess we were scared that people weren't going to stay tuned, so we really jazzed up the top of the show.
There's something that the kids say out there. To confuse is to get close to God.
So well, we did some confusing things.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, and that's part of it, right? You don't always want people knowing exactly what you're doing. You want them to figure it out, and our audience is pretty smart.
When I would come into the studio with like a bunch of instruments, would you be like, oh, great? Or would you be like, oh God, no. What was it?
Maybe a little column A, a little column B.
We have a couple examples, right?
We do. Well, we have the one that got us in the most trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Right. The end of the world as we know it.
That's right.
Some evangelist said there's going to be the end of the world that day. So we did a little song. I played all the instruments. Celeste was the co-host, Celeste Headley, and
not just a couple of guitars either. You came in and played saxophone. I think there might have been a flute on.
Okay, so John, you have any weekend plans?
No.
Really?
No. I mean, haven't you heard? It's the end of the world as we know it.
Doomsday comes out of the world.
Listen to what I'm saying. It's the end of the world as we know
dogs
it.
Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Aloha means goodbye.
It's the end of the world as we know it. Nevermore.
You maniac!
What kind of damage?
Total, sir.
My God.
That
Horrible.
That's why we keep all these instruments in here, too. People don't realize, you know, we got this drum in here. We got a couple of xylophones.
I'm taking them all. They're packed up. Out of here.
The following takes place between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m.
Nuclear terrorism, dirty bombs, so last season rerun.
We don't take orders from anybody but the President of the United States. Now move.
An international conference at the White House claims it will finally deal with dirty bombs and terrorist nukes. Is the reality of nuclear terrorism just catching up to TV?
The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised. Will not be televised. Not be televised.
Photo ops and rogue nukes. 24 may be canceled.
Events occur in real time.
But nuclear terrorism may just be getting started.
The revolution will be live.
On The Takeaway. We used everything. Well, TV shows, canceled stuff, anything. Sometimes, though, I mean, it just fell in her lap.
Whoa! Are you ready?
Imagine abolishing the IRS. Imagine it's 1775. I am announcing that I'm running for President of the United States.
I do care. Obama cares anymore. Obama cares.
It's Obamacare.
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 I eat breakfast 300 yards from 4,000 Cubans who are trained to kill me, so don't think for one second that you can come down here, flash a badge, and make me nervous.
Hey, the Pentagon doesn't need Jack Nicholson to express its disapproval over the latest classified leaks about Gitmo prisoners. News organizations open the thorny question of who stays and who gets released from the world's legal black hole called Guantanamo. The story of more than a few scary men. On The Takeaway.
Did you order the code red? You did order the code red, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
We used a few good men.
Yeah.
Dozens of times.
Yeah.
Although dozens of times.
That gets used a lot. That's,
oh, yeah.
That's a part of Americana. That's kind of like the Lincoln Memorial.
To be clear, it's important to give credit where it's due. The first technical director of the show, his name is Dylan Keefe, and yep. He's now the Radiolab's sound designer. The other guy on the show
There's
that I've worked
no
with.
No way he has as much fun on Radiolab as he had with us.
Well, he doesn't no get way. To make a show every day.
Yeah. That's true.
There's also our man Vince Fairchild, yep. Who's been our longtime sound designer engineer.
Vince created our crashing of the George Clooney fundraising Hollywood party for Barack Obama's 2012 election.
That's right.
Now, where is the host, Mr. Clooney?
For such a smart person, you really are lost, aren't you?
Well, hi, George. Who wouldn't be lost in a place like this? I'm not lost. I'm just looking for the way to the bathroom. Tell me how to find it.
This place houses a security system that rivals most nuclear missile silos. Through these doors, each of which requires a different six-digit code changed every 12 hours. Past those lies the elevator. This is where it gets tricky.
Whoa, George. Hey, you know, some little powder room, like a half bath, is fine for me.
The elevator shaft is rigged with motion detectors. Two more guards with Uzis and the most elaborate vault door ever conceived by man.
You know, I think I'll just hold it.
I love that.
I just, you know, taking stuff out of context. Oh, I'll miss that. I'll miss that.
You got to take people places, you know, even if they're not exactly totally real.
Welcome to another edition of Takeaway Travel. We're live on the eighth moon of Upsilon Andromeda D, a gas giant approximately 10 times the size of Jupiter.
Whoa.
See that breathtaking sky? Each day, this moon has that and a planet rise. Beat that, Cancun.
What was your favorite thing to make on this show?
Favorite thing to make? I think it was just the idea that we could do anything. The idea when you come in the morning, it was like anything could happen within reason. There's a pile of executive producers who could say, no, it's not anything. But
where are they now?
Just make sure you have fun on this show. Without me around, all right?
I'll try, man.
You try.
Thank you for everything, man. All this sound design is, you know, part of your brain's in it. So that's our goal. Keep it going.
All I will say is carry on.
All right, man. I'll see you on the other side.
That was Jake Howitt, sound designer and technical director for The Takeaway, who is not going anywhere, by the way. So, So what do you say about nearly 10 years of your life measured out in radio programs? For me, it's that long, though not for most of the rest of you, since this show was birthed in the shadows of a long-forgotten mission to become a public radio alternative in morning drive time. That goal, written in grant proposals and pitches, launched The Takeaway. Then two of the biggest stories of this century, the election of Barack Obama and the financial debacle that almost took down the global economy, lifted us steadily as a place where people could hear ideas mixed with news, the occasional laugh, a way of speaking and thinking that said you could have power over the things you couldn't control by understanding them, beyond scandals and silly showdowns and even unsatisfying elections. But as a Don Quixote tilting at windmills, the likes of me and my co-hosts in those days, Adore Udoji and Celeste Headlee, were not about to slow the mighty veins of Morning Edition on public radio, right? So 5 years ago, The Takeaway became a one-hour daytime program with a single host. Me. There, another, to my mind, more worthy mission would thrive. I've always felt, you see, that the news is a bit of a con, or less than meets the eye sometimes. So much talk about the United States in the world's media, it makes no sense. The antics of Trump, Putin, Modi, Merkel, Xi Jinping, how much do they matter in your lives really? I've always sensed there's a hunger out there to find deeper answers to more haunting questions like, what do I do in civic society? How do I make change when voting seems so beside the point? Why do things seem so broken? Why do smart people seem so silly once they get political power? Why do some of those smart people proceed into flag-waving debacles that go on for years and manufacture enemies that don't really threaten us, kill our best and bravest for nothing, it seems, turn others into the burned and maimed for life, turn still others into vessels of confused rage who live among us? How can being interested in the news be the beginning of something bigger than finding out just what's going to happen tomorrow? And that's been my mission throughout my career, confronting those questions, not just the headlines. During my time in the Middle East, in Africa, for instance, when looking at a little Palestinian boy holding onto a carton of eggs while soldiers and militants towered over him and battled in the streets of Jerusalem, that was the memorable image that taught me to think that the headline that day was less important than what that little boy would grow up and feel as a man. He was the story, that day and now. But the reporters all ignored him, including me. But I've never forgotten him. Or how in Somalia, a village of well-fed, even obese people allowed the people in the next village to starve and die. We don't want to become skeleton people, one woman said, teaching me that famine is political, actually, when a society breaks down completely. Then one time on a show called Heat, back in 1990 on public radio, here at this station, WNYC, we were doing a lot of shows on religious conservatives and their impact in politics and wondering about the influence of folks like Jerry Falwell and Phyllis Schlafly, until a little girl on the show read her poetry. We were doing something on a writing program here in New York City. And she said in one line, "Religions are like radiators, everywhere and nowhere." I mean, it just blew me away, this little girl. I never forgot it. It stayed in my mind. It's deepened my understanding of religious politics. And it's an understanding that was delivered by nothing we would ever call news. You know, I met up with that little girl, all grown up and married with a daughter, years later. She came to an event in Boston one time to thank me for that moment on the radio that she said taught her to value her own thoughts and ideas. So for me, you see, that's public radio. People with confidence, gaining confidence about their truths and then sharing them. A way of speaking that makes people turn on their curiosity, switch it right on. A way of questioning, interviewing, that also makes listeners want to ask their own questions. A public radio that's suspicious of feeling like a club of all the same kind of people, that believes curiosity is the birthing room for political action, and that engaged communities are the lifeblood of politics. And so here at the end of my work on The Takeaway, this show is being held aloft by arguably another of the biggest stories of the century, the Trump phenomenon, Here and now, we mean to explore, investigate, be unafraid in our critiques and uncynical in our hard looks at what we believe is really going on. It's what this show does, a show about democracy and the power of all of us, prodded sometimes, I suppose, by a host who's doing more than just reading. And this program, The Takeaway, will be doing that long after I'm gone. And it's what I'll be doing wherever I go next. Long after I say, take a breath, John. Goodbye.
Karen from South Salem, New York. John, I can only wish you the best. You've taught me, made me laugh, made me think about what I'm going to value and fight for given the state of our country. Many thanks and much success in your next adventure.
Hey, John, it's Kevin from Manchester, New Hampshire. You have done an awesome job. I don't know how many years I've been listening to you, but you have made me a better listener. God bless you, son. Man, you've done a great job to help inform the American public.
Genevieve LaRiva, Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I've enjoyed The Takeaway so much. It has been the accompaniment to my cooking solo in the kitchen, a backdrop to the sun descending on the New York skyline.
This is Jim Lyons in Dallas, Texas. I wanted to just thank you for all the work you've done to make my brain a little bit better.
My name is Lori. I'm calling from Valhalla, New York. And, John, it will be difficult when 3 o'clock rolls around and your familiar, incisive, and humorous commentary is not to be found. There you were to keep me company through my disability challenges and many, many operations. And thank you for being there for all of us.
Huckenberry, this is Marion in Southern Pines, North Carolina. I want to offer you a deep bow of gratitude, John, for your being the very best of company. You have been my North Star.
This is Larry Fisher from Brooklyn, New York. For me, about The Takeaway Show with Hockenberry was that when the show ended, the conversations kept going for me and the people I was around.
Bill from Brooklyn, your incisive, probing questions will be greatly missed, as well as your voice and your mind. And what's next?
Hello, John. This is Michelle from Honolulu and Kaneohe. And I just wanted to say thank you for your insight, your dedication, everything on The Takeaway.
John, it's Paul from Chatham, New Jersey. Aren't you the new guy? I remember when you were. You still seem like the same fresh and exciting mind you always were. Good luck on your next adventures. You've earned that luck.
Wow. That one nailed it there at the end. You still feel like the new guy. I would have never thought of that. That makes me very happy. And, you know, if Michelle out there in Honolulu would let me just sort of come out and put a tent in her yard, maybe, that would be good. There's still some summer left. Thanks to all of you for listening. I felt you all out there. I would encounter people on the street all over the country. It's a community. It's a national conversation. It looks so dumb on a memo in planning, but we made it real. Thanks, guys. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.